Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming, and thanks to the organizers for this opportunity to talk here. So I had a very good time at Perimeter Institute in 2017 when I was visiting there. I hope I can visit there again soon in the future. So today I'm going to talk about gravitational gyroscope memory, or gyroscopic gravitational memory. So this is a proposal for detecting the so-called gravitational memory effects with gyroscopes. And this is based on a work in collaboration with Blaja Oblak, which is already submitted to archive, and it will appear, in fact, tomorrow. So don't forget to check archive tomorrow. So let me start by an introduction on gravitational wave memory effects. So this is simply the fact that gravitational waves are not purely oscillatory waveforms, but they include a non-oscillatory piece that builds up over time and leads to a final offset in the waveform. This is what we call the gravitational wave memory effect. And this is in fact an observable effect, but the problem with that is that it's a low frequency effect. And we know that our detectors have poor sensitivity in the low frequency. But still, there are prospects for detection of memory effects with our detectors in the near future. For example, with LIGO, it's not possible to detect memory in a single event, but still it is possible to verify the memory effect statistically, in the sense that you can gather many data, many detections, and check whether the data prefers the signal with memory to the signal without memory. And this you can do with some Bayesian model selection methods. And the conclusion of this analysis is that if you have like order 2000 signals, then you have good, you can say that you have detected the memory with enough precision. This means order 5 years of data collection. With LISA, the space-based detector of gravitational waves, which is supposed to be launched in 2034, the story is very different. With LISA, you have the opportunity to detect memory effects in a single event, namely from the merger of two supermassive black holes, which is, by the way, a rare event, but in case we have such an event, then we can see its memory signal. So if you look at this plot, this black line is the sensitivity curve of LISA, in the sense that whatever above it is observable. This orange line is the usual in-spiral signal, and this blue line is the memory contribution to that. And as you see in this region of frequency, we have the possibility to observe the memory. Okay, so there are different ways to detect memory in the gravitational wave. In other words, there are different physical observables for this effect. The most studied one is the so-called displacement memory, which is the simple experiment that if you have two freely falling test masses, which are initially at rest with respect to each other, then if the gravitational waves pass through this system, they start to oscillate and they end up in a separation which is different from their initial separation. This is called the displacement memory. There are other observables for the memory, for example, the so-called kick memory effect, which is the simple fact that if in the same setup, if the test masses have some initial relative velocity, then as a result of the gravitational wave, there is a net kick or a net change in the relative velocity of the test masses. And then there is also this so-called spin memory effect, which is in fact a Sagnac interferometer. So you have the setup is again simple. You have a closed path in which two counter-orbiting light beams are orbiting in this path, and then as a result of the passage of gravitational waves, there is a difference in the period of these orbits, and you can show that this time difference can be related to the gravitational wave memories. Then finally, what I want to discuss in this talk is what I call the gyroscope memory or gyroscopic memory, which is the fact that if you have a gyroscope far from the source, then when the gravitational waves pass through the gyroscope, there is a net change in the orientation of the gyroscope. So let me end my introduction with this cartoon. So you have, this is the Penrose diagram of asymptotically flat spacetimes, and you have some source, let's say a binary system, which is emitting gravitational waves. And then you consider a gyroscope that is moving in the spacetime, let's say freely falling. And then this gyroscope has some initial orientation, and when the gravitational waves pass through the gyroscope, there is a net change in the orientation of the gyroscope. So this is the effect that I want to discuss in the following. So if there's any question, please ask. So yes. So the dynamics of the spin of the gyroscope with four velocity u and the spin s is given by the Fermi-Walker transport equation. So this is an equation designed in a way that the spin of the gyroscope is always orthogonal to the velocity of the gyroscope, and is given by this equation. So this is a simple generalization of the well-known parallel transport equation. Then in practice, an observer measures the spin in a local Lorentz frame. So the observer writes the spin in terms of some basis vectors, e mu hat. So this is a set of four basis vectors, which have these orthogonality relations. Then if the observer is co-moving with the gyroscope and the frame is adapted to the observer in the sense that the zeroth basis vector is equal to the four velocity of the observer, then the spin is purely spatial, and the dynamics of the spin is given by this simple equation, where the precession rates are given in terms of this quantity, which is called the spin connections. So these are the analogs of the Christoffel symbols in the frame formulation. And note that since by construction, this omega ij is antisymmetric, the magnitude of the spin is preserved, but it's only the orientation which is changing with time. In other words, the gyroscope is precessing. Okay, given this result, we know that the dynamics of the gyroscope depends on three quantities: the metric of the spacetime, the world line of the gyroscope, and the frame that you consider. So let me discuss these three one by one. For the metric, we consider asymptotically flat spacetimes in Bondi gauge, This is a very good setup to study gravitational waves generated by localized sources, such as binary systems. Then, for the world line, we can either consider freely falling gyroscopes, which is what I concentrate on in this talk. And you can also consider more general cases like accelerated gyroscopes, and this you can see in the paper. And for the frame, we have, as you know, there is a huge gauge freedom, the so-called local Lorentz transformations. And it's necessary to fix a frame to be able to discuss the changes in the orientation of the gyroscope, because you have to say the orientation changes with respect to which fixed directions. And therefore, we define in the following a frame which is tied to the distant stars. And this is kind of a fixed frame for us, because everything is relative in GR, so this is the best that you can do, as I will discuss later. Okay, so let's discuss these three points one by one. For the metric, as I said, we consider the Van de Sachs formalism. This is so the starting point is the Bondi gauge. So we consider a coordinate system consisting of the retarded time u, radius r, and angular coordinates xa, and you impose some gauge conditions, which are called the Bondi gauge, in which the general metric takes this general form. And the metric, as you see, is determined by four objects, four quantities, two scalars, beta and f, one vector on the sphere, ua, and one symmetric tensor on the sphere, gamma eb. And you can see that for any metric in this class, this coordinate u is always light-like. R is always the aerial distance, in the sense that a coordinate sphere has always the area 4 pi r squared. And then there is a preferred vector field, which I call L, which is e to the minus 2 beta times partial r. And you can show that this vector is tangent to a fine outgoing null geodetics. Physically, it represents null rays generated by the source. Okay, and this is a simple picture of the Penrose diagram. This metric. Now, we have these four unknown quantities. So you have to solve for these quantities using the Einstein equations. And you need to impose some boundary condition to ensure that the space-time is asymptotically flat. And for this, it is enough to impose that this gamma AB limits to the round metric on the sphere. So this is our boundary condition. And I consider this to be really the round metric on the sphere without time dependence, and the Ricci scalar of this is equal to 2. There are more general boundary conditions, for example, as discussed in papers by Laurent. Okay, so we impose these boundary conditions, and since we're assuming that, since we want to study the dynamics of GR far from the source, we perform an expansion in powers of 1 over r, 1 over distance, like this, and then you solve Einstein equations order by order in 1 over r. And when you do that, this is the solution. Well, the details are not so important. There are some important quantities appearing in this expansion. The first one is called the Bondi shear, which contains the well-known plus and cross polarizations of the metric perturbation. So this is really the gravitational wave. And then there are so-called mass aspect and angular momentum aspect. And then the Bondi news is the time derivative turns out to be the time derivative of the Bondish yield. Then you have three more equations, which are called balance equations, which give you the time evolution of the mass aspect and the angular momentum aspect in terms of the radiation fields. So there are linear terms here, as you see, and quadratic terms, quadratic fluxes, which are given here. Very good. So now let me discuss, so this was for the metric, and now let me discuss the word line of the gyroscope. And for this, I write the velocity in this form, and I solve the geodesic equation asymptotically, and this is the result that you find. So this is for a geodesic which is initially at rest at some initial point. So this is the asymptotic expression for the geodesic. So, I mean, this you find after some tedious calculation, but you can check that it makes sense in the sense that, for example, if you consider the static matrix where M is just a constant M0 and the angular momentum aspect is zero and the shear is also zero, you see that any of these terms drop. And then the only non-trivial term comes from, so you see that this first term in the radial velocity is zero because M equals M naught. The leading term is minus time integral of M. This gamma two is time integral of M over R squared. And as you see, this is just the Newtonian force. Because the acceleration is minus m over r squared. And then another nice point is that, as you see here, the leading part of the angular velocity of the geodesic is given by this expression, which actually coincides with the leading part of this function, this vector ua in the metric, which I showed in the previous slide here, yes, here. So somehow the angular velocity of the geodesic, which was initially at rest, is given by the leading part of the metric. And this is kind of, let's say, a dragging of floating particles by gravitational waves. Okay, and now the technical part is to construct a frame. So I do this in two steps. First, I introduce a frame which I call the source-oriented frame. And this is a natural frame that you can define in this setup. But then I show that this is not enough for discussing the gyroscope memory effect because it appears at subleading orders. So you have to be even more precise. And to do that, we transform from the source-oriented frame to the frame that is adapted to distant stars, as I will discuss. So the source-oriented frame is a set of four basis vectors in which one of the basis vectors is adapted to the gyroscope velocity. And another one is always pointing to the source. Recall that this vector L was the tangent vector to outgoing null geodesics. And therefore, this basis vector is somehow parallel to that, except that you have to project out its time component. Then demanding orthogonality conditions, you see that the frame is completed by two other vectors, which are tangent to the sphere and are given by these expressions. So these two vectors are given by these coefficients zeta a hat. These actually form a dyad on the sphere in the sense that they solve this equation. And note that these zetas although tangent to the sphere depend also on time and radius. But since you have the asymptotic expansion for gamma ib, you know the asymptotic expansion for these zetas. And as you see, they're given by some zeta bar. And these are really a fixed dyad on the sphere. So these only depend on angle and not on time or radius. And then the other dependencies are completely fixed. Okay, so this was the source-oriented frame, but there is a subtlety, or there's a problem with this this frame, which is that if you consider a moving gyroscope in Minkowski background, you expect that it does not, its spin is preserved in time. It doesn't precess. But you see that in this frame, there is a precession of the gyroscope. And this is because these spin connections are not zero. This is not a physical effect, but a spurious effect because of the fact that the frame is not the spin that is rotating, but the frame that is rotating. And the fact that, in the sense that the frame has to adapt itself to the source at each location, at each angle. But the good side is that these spin connections, as you can see, are completely fixed by the asymptotic structure that we have fixed in this Bondi framework. You remember that as a boundary condition, I imposed that QAB is fixed, and these zeta bars are somehow the dyad fixed with respect to that metric. And therefore, you can cancel this spurious effect by an angle-dependent rotation once for all. And in physical terms, this rotation defines for you a frame which is tied to distant stars at infinite distance rather than to the source at finite distance. Of course, the distance to the source is large, but not infinite. So this is the picture that you should have in mind. So the black frame is the source-oriented frame. As you see, at this point, the two frames coincide, but when you rotate, when you go to this point, the source-oriented frame is this black one, while the red one is the frame that is tied to the distance, the rays arriving from the distant stars. So to do this in terms of equations, as I said, you have to perform a rotation. So the new frame is given by E prime. Still the zeroth basis vector is aligned with the velocity, but there is a rotation in the spatial vectors under which the spin connections transforms as usual. And you solve for this rotation by demanding that the spin connections are zero for the Minkowski background in the new frame. And this gives the rotation as a path ordered exponential of the background spin connections. And if you plug this back to this equation, you find that the spin connections in the frame tied to distant stars is given by this expression. And you see this nice combination that kills the spurious effect in the spin connections. Okay, and note that in practice, you can ignore, I mean, for the purpose of our work, you can ignore these R's in front because the angular displacement of the gyroscope is very tiny because it's very far from the source. And therefore, you can approximate these rotations by the identity matrix. And therefore, the precession rates are simply given by this expression. Okay, so we can compute these expressions for a freely falling gyroscope. And here are the results that we find. So we find that the precession is only transverse. So the RA component of the precession is zero. It's only transverse to the sphere. And since an anti-symmetric tensor and the sphere should be proportional to the epsilon, so it's given by a scalar omega. And this this scalar, which gives the precession rate, is given by this expression.
It's just a question. This is the dual mass, right? The covariant dual mass.
Exactly. This is where I'm going to. Mm-hmm. Yes, just one slide. So two remarks here. As I said, this is a transverse effect. And the second point is that because of the equivalence principle, I mean, okay, know that this precession is completely dictated by the gravitational field, and it is independent of the properties of the gyroscope. For example, it's independent of the moments of inertia and the spin of the gyroscope. And this is a manifestation of the equivalence principle, because otherwise you could somehow understand that you could detect GR in a freely falling frame. Okay, as Laurent said, there is a nice interpretation for this precession. So to see that, define the dual of some tensor and the sphere in this way by contracting one index with the epsilon tensor. Then you can see that this precession rate is 1 over r squared times this quantity m tilde, where m tilde is given by this expression. And this expression was something called the dual covariant mass aspect by Laurent and Daniele in a recent paper. Actually, they obtained this expression from a totally different computation by demanding covariance and so on. Anyway, this dual covariant mass aspect has nice properties. One, that it transforms covariantly under superrotations, and it has weight 3/2. This guy is the electromagnetic dual of the covariant mass aspect that was defined before as the sum of the mass aspect, the bonding mass aspect, plus this quadratic combination. Again, this quantity transformed covariantly under superrotations with the same weight. And moreover, it was shown in this paper that these two quantities form the leading order in the psi 2 in the Newman-Penrose formalism. Okay, and then you can show that the integral of the dual mass aspect smeared by some function on the sphere defines a dual supertranslation charge. So this is not the usual expression that you find in the literature, but you can show that it's up to some subtlety in the non-integrable part of the syntactic form and so on. This can be used to define a dual supertranslation charge. So we see that, I mean, the conclusion up to now is that the freely falling gyroscope precession provides a measurement protocol for this dual covariant mass aspect. Okay, so far so good. And now let me discuss the gyroscope memory. Up to now we discussed the precession. Now I want to discuss the memory. And for that, let me introduce another mathematical tool, which is the parity decomposition of quantities on the sphere. For example, you can decompose, I mean, note that the shear is symmetric and traceless, so it consists of 2 degrees of freedom. So you can decompose it into 2 scalars, which I call C plus and C minus, with 2 derivatives, as you see. And for example, you can also decompose a vector on the sphere in terms of two scalars, L plus and L minus. And these expressions can be inverted as follows. You can do the same for C plus and C minus, but I don't need that here. If we do this parity decomposition, we can see that the balance equation for the angular momentum aspect gives this equation. So you see that only C minus appears here, and this calligraphic D is a fourth order differential on the sphere. So now, if you expand your dual mass aspect in terms of this C plus and C minus, you see that the linear term is exactly this combination plus a quadratic flux term like that. And if you use this balanced equation, we can finally write the dual covariant mass aspect in this form. And from this, it is obvious that the precession rate is zero for non-radiative spacetimes because, first of all, the fluxes are zero, and the angular momentum aspect is constant, so its time derivative is zero. So there's no precession when there's no radiation. Okay, so this is what I found, that there is a precession in the transverse components. And now I want to compute the memory. So the memory is the time integral of the precession. So I integrate this equation over time and I find this this equation. This is not a solution still to that. This is a formal, well, integral differential equation because on the right-hand side, I still have S. So, but I can solve this equation by iteration. And the good point is that because I'm assuming that the gyroscope is far from the source, I can stop at the first iteration. And then I find that the total change, the net change in the spin is given by this expression. So it's just the time integral of the dual covariant mass aspect. And this guy is given by the change in the angular momentum aspect plus two flux terms. Okay, so let me, okay. Now I want to show the relation between these memory effects and the symmetries of the theory. So let me massage this result a bit by recalling that the L minus, as I said, can be related to the vector LA in this way, where this d minus 2 is the inverse Laplacian, which can be written as Green's function integral. So if I do that, I see that I have an integral over the sphere, Green function, and these expressions. Then I can integrate by part to put the derivatives on the Green function, and therefore I find this combination here. So this is vector on the sphere multiplied by this. And therefore, I can write the memory in this nice suggestive form where this Q is actually the super rotation charge. This Y is actually this, this vector field, which is, if you want, area preserving diffeomorphism on the sphere. And then this F of Y is the flux of super rotation charges. So you see that the memory is the change in the super rotation charge and the flux of the super rotation charge. So plus this additional flux term, which I discuss in the following. So this already establishes the link between the gyroscope memory and super rotations or DFS2 symmetries of the generalized BMS symmetries.
F tilde, what is F tilde?
So yes, exactly. This is what I want to discuss now. So this F tilde is this integral. And this comes from the second term is in the dual covariant mass aspect, as you remember. So what is this guy? Is there a symmetry interpretation of this expression or not? And the answer is yes, but it's not related to a space-time symmetry, but it's related to a duality symmetry. So consider the following transformation. So if you transform CAB to C prime AB, which is, I mean, this is the usual electric magnetic duality transformation in a gravitational field. So if you want, this transformation sends mass multiple moments to spin multiple moments and vice versa. So if you now, if you compute the generator of this transformation, first of all, you can check that this is a symmetry of the radiative phase space in the sense that it preserves this Ashtekar-Struble symplectic structure. And therefore you can associate a charge to this transformation. By the way, note that this epsilon here is not a constant. It can be a function on the sphere. So it's kind of a local duality transformation on the sphere. So if we contract the symplectic form with this symmetry transformation, we find that the generator is first of all integrable and is given by this expression, which is exactly this one integrated over the sphere smeared with some parameter epsilon. So to summarize, I can write the memory, as I said, in this form, and the memory is given by this sum of these two terms coming from the super rotations plus this term, which is actually the generator of the duality transformation, where the epsilon here is just a delta function, which means that it localizes this generator to the observation point. So this is somewhat the main message of this work. And then finally, let me establish.
A question about that. If you were to compare to the mass memory effect, would you have the same decomposition? Maybe you're doing that later. To the translation memory effect.
Ah, you mean the displacement memory?
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Okay. Okay, good question. So if there is a relative velocity between the test masses, there is a correction to the displacement memory. And if I'm not mistaken, that correction can be related to some fluxes associated to super boost symmetries.
Okay, so instead of your super rotation, you will have super boost. Okay.
Yes, but this relation to duality is, I think, new. I mean, I've never seen such a thing appearing.
And of course.
Right, and then, yeah. Okay, yes. So let me finish by saying a word about the relation between this work and the spin memory effect as discussed by Pasterski, Strominger, and Shubadov. So as I said, their setup was a Sagnac interferometer. And you can check even in Wikipedia that the Sagnac effect, so this delta T, for if you have some rotation, some angular velocity in your setup, in your Sagnac interferometer, given by omega as a two form, the delta T is given by this time integral of omega over the area. And then now we have this omega for gravitational waves, and we can simply plug that here and compute the integral. So to relate to the spin memory, I assume that the size of the interferometer is much smaller than the typical wavelength of the gravitational wave. And therefore I can ignore this second term to the first term because it's off by a factor L over lambda. And then you can see that this first term is an exact term. It's D of some one form, which I call U naught. And U naught is this expression. I call it U naught because it's the, if you remember, it's the leading part of the angular component of the metric. Yeah. And it, as I mentioned, it coincides with the leading part of the angular velocity of freely falling geodesics. So if I plug this expression in my integral, I find the delta t is simply this integral, and this exactly matches with the result of Pasterski et al. So therefore, our analysis reproduces this spin memory effect in this limit. Okay, let me summarize. So I mentioned that the precession measures the dual covariant mass aspect. The memory was related to area preserving diffs on the sphere, plus an important additional flux term that generates the electromagnetic duality. And then we reproduce the spin memory as a special case. But for the future, I think the electric magnetic duality in GR is very interesting, and its relation to asymptotic symmetries is very interesting. As you know, there are some works on the relation between electric magnetic duality and asymptotic symmetries in the context of Maxwell's theory, and there is some tension in the literature and so on. Central extensions might appear. So this is very interesting. And I have one work in collaboration with Mark Hanno in this regard. And then there is another interesting aspect, which is that, for example, we saw here that this spin memory effect was kind of a Wilson loop integral. But you can show that, in fact, most of, or maybe even all of the known memory effects can be written as Wilson loops. And this is what I'm working on now with Tormolino postdoc here in Brussels. Then there is another interesting aspect for memory effects, which is its relation to Berry phases in fluid dynamics and in the adiabatic evolution of quantum systems. So somehow this suggests a holographic interpretation of memory effects in terms of some dual theory, if you want. And this is what I'm working on with Blaja Oblak and Marius Petropoulos. And then finally, I think there's a big question whether there is a fluid dynamical effective description of the celestial holography. And I think all these different ingredients will eventually fit in that big picture. So yes, thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks, Ali, for the very nice talk.
You're welcome.
Okay, are there questions? First from students. So I don't see questions from students, but so there is an anonymous question that I'm now copying in the chat. And the question is whether this result depends on whether one uses Bondi or Neumann Unti gauge, specifically referring to the fall-off of GUR, the GUR part.
Okay. Yes. Sorry. Okay, so the question is whether this depends on GUR. So, very good. Let me go back. Yes. So for Neumann-Onti gauge, you can set this beta to one, and then you don't have this determine a condition for the for gamma IB, but still you can, in human anti-gauge, you can impose that the shear is traceless, and therefore asymptotically the both gauges look the same. But I don't think there is a change. I mean, first of all what we did was in a local frame. So, I mean, although we started from the metric formulation, but then we transformed everything to the frame language. So if you start from any gauge, then you can, I mean, at the end, when you go to the frame language, it's independent of the gauge that you imposed on the metric. So I would say it doesn't depend on the choice of gauge. Yes.
Yeah, maybe if I can add something. Like that. I
mean, yes, please.
You kind of said it. Like the observable is gauge invariant. And in fact, so you presented the calculation, the Bondi gauge, but as you mentioned at some point, you know, the covariant dual mass, it's called the covariant dual mass because it doesn't depend on the gauge. It's an element of the Weyl tensor, and therefore it is completely, gauge invariant. I mean, that's what it's designed for. It's an observable.
Yeah.
Okay, I hope this answered the question of the person who asked the anonymous question. Are there more questions or comments? Bianca?
Yeah, hi. Can you comment on when we can possibly measure this gyroscopic memory effect?
Right, this is actually a good question. So all of the current gravitational wave detectors are based on somehow the measurement of distances rather than the measurement of orientations. For example, LIGO, LISA, whatever, all of them are based on measuring distances. So when they say, I mean, in the first slides, I talked about measuring memory in these detectors. But all of these are referring to this first kind of memory observable, which is the displacement memory. I don't think for the moment, I know there is one experiment, I guess it was called Gravity Probe B, something like that, some years ago, which was trying to measure the frame dragging effect by the gravitational field of the Earth on gyroscopes. And this, it was kind of successful, but to detect gravitational waves by gyroscopes, I don't think there is any experiment designed for the near future. I don't know any.
Okay, thanks.
Let me just add a comment, which is that the effect which I discussed here was at order of 1/r². And for both of these, in this picture that you see, for the spin memory and the gyroscope memory, these two effects are 1/r², and the square of the distance, but these two effects are 1/r. So these are kind of dominant effects, and these are subdominant. But the important thing about these two experiments is that they capture, as I have written here, they capture gravitomagnetic effects, while these two capture gravitoelectric effects. So these are different, I mean, complementary aspects.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Sure.
More questions or comments? I see that Daniele is unmuted. You want to say something?
No, I mean, I was about just to ask actually what you just said about the leading subleading order, because I would expect that the dual magnetic, the dual mass effect would be of the same order of the standard mass effect. But why is it subleading with respect to the mass? I mean, the charge has you mentioned some point that there is a dual translation charge associated with. Isn't that the same order of the standard translation charge? May you consider a different vector field for the dual translation, or?
No. For the to define the dual super translation charges, you consider the same super translation, but you it's for super translation, but it's kind of duality.
I guess the question is, because you say it's a dual, there's a duality. The duality usually leave R invariant. I guess that's that, right?
But the thing is that for example,
is it because of the probe? Because you're measuring, I don't know, something different.
Maybe there is some probe. I'm not excluding the possibility there is some probe of this dual mass aspect which appears at order 1 over R. Maybe there is, but I'm saying that if you look at gyroscopes, mm-hmm. this effect appears at 1 over R squared, mm-hmm. but I'll be very happy to find a leading effect in which you can find this dual mass aspect, dual quantities in general. But usually the magnetic quantities are subleading with respect to electric quantities, but I'm not excluding that, but this is a good question.
What about something like Thomas precessions in atoms where, you know, the way people measure the velocity of light? Have you thought about that? Like, not just classical gyroscope, but some kind of atomic effect that are, you know, enhanced by the fact that you spin a lot of time. Is it too small, or have you thought about that? Is the spin too small to be measurable? Would have a, you know, can it have a spectral effect?
So you want some kind of...
About the electron orbiting, you know, like the Thomas precession effect. This is the way people measure the speed of light. The fact that, you know, if you spin 10,000 times, then a small effect adds up. You have a secular kind of boost coming from there. So,
but then, what is the relation to gravitational waves?
Well, is that you have a kind of this microscopical gyroscope. So the spin is affected by that. It's a gyroscope, right?
I understand. So we want to put some atom or whatever in, subject to gravitational waves, and see how the spin of the electron evolves in time, something like that.
Yeah, and it affects, whether it's measurable or not, in the sense that there you accumulate a very long
time. Okay, so in that case, there is the spin is not freely falling. There is an additional force, which is the electric force. And therefore, one has to, here in this talk, I consider freely falling gyroscopes. Yeah. But then if you consider accelerated gyroscopes, maybe you have something more dominant. Yes, actually, this is a good point. And maybe this answers the previous question. We have discussed a bit this accelerated case, but not in very much detail. But yes, I need to think more about it.
Are there more questions?
Do you know if this covariant dual mass is taken into account into the, like this memory effect? My understanding is that people who design waveform are not taking that into account. The fact that there's a secular, you know, the dual translation displacement. And do you think that maybe that could, it means that there's an option that we can go back to the design of waveforms and you know, upgrade the templates. I know people have done for the super memory effect, but
yes,
this is in some sense could be even more dominant.
Okay, so the thing is that in numerical relativity, up to now, up to very recently, all the templates were kind of oscillatory. There was no memory in the in this template banks that they have. But very recently, some groups have started to add the memory effect to the waveform. For example, some groups in Cornell, Tokolsky et al., and so on. They are doing this for. So they're doing this for both the, I mean, unfortunately, the language is a bit different. I mean, in the post-Newtonian language, you have a bit different, but. So you think about mass multiple moments and spin multiple moments, and then the memory effects are somehow contained in these multiple moments. So if you study the memory effects in the mass multiples, this is somehow related to this standard super translation memory effects. Then when you study the spin, the memory effects in the spin multiple moments, then this is because the spin multiple moments is related to kind of gravitomagnetic effects, then you naturally relate to super rotations and dual quantities and so on. So I think sort of they can consider this, but again, it turns out that the memory effects in the mass multiple moments, it is more dominant than the memory effects in the spin multiple moments, dominant in the sense of post-Newtonian expansion. But still, you can study both effects. But to relate it to this symmetries of the Bondi gauge is a bit subtle, because in that context, people are more used to harmonic gauge and all the post-Newtonian framework is written in the harmonic gauge. To translate that language to the Bondi-Sachs language, you have to perform a coordinate transformation. And this is what I did in collaboration with Luc Blanchet and collaborators. So we did that at leading order in the first paper, and now we are working on the extension of that to the second order, and then we will be able to talk about memory effects. So I hope I can say more about that soon. I don't know if that partly answered.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's a huge literature on memory effects in the context of post-Newtonian theory. And yes, relating that to things that people know in the context of Bondi, and I mean, the more theoretical approaches, it is actually a good question.
More questions? But actually, let me ask something that might be a very naive question. Say that there is this type of memory effect, and in this case, one would be able to detect something in a gravitational wave signal. What would I be able to learn about modification of gravity or modification of the waves form precisely? Would there be, for instance, some amplification effects that would allow to better understand, for instance, modifications of the axon or modification of the symmetries?
Yes, you want to see if by just observing the memory, one can somehow constrain the theory of GR or something
beyond
like
the
that.
GR. Yes, what would they learn about?
I'm not sure. I've never seen discussions about that. But for example, something, maybe this is not directly related to your question, but something that we can do and it's very non-trivial is that our detectors have some finite frequency band. Outside that, there are noises and so on. So we are limited to this frequency range. So, for example, LISA is sensitive to memories, extreme mass ratio in spirals, or supermassive binaries, things like that. But then suppose that there is a very high frequency process, which we don't know what it is. Then for that process, which we don't see in our detector because our frequency range is limited, the thing is that the memory effect associated to that process, which we don't know, can lie in the frequency band of our detector. And therefore, by observing that, we can learn about things that are beyond our detection band. Or if you don't see anything in our frequency band, we can put constraint on something that some high frequency processes that we don't see. So in this way, memory effects provide some extension of the frequency band of our detector. So this is some non-trivial thing that you can do with memory effects. But to constrain the theory with memory design, don't know, and it is a very good question, actually.
Also a nice question. I guess that it's difficult to see anyhow.
It's kind
but
of...
But yeah, thanks for answering
yes.
Sensibly. Are there more... some final questions or comments? Okay, so if not, thanks again, Ali, for the nice talk and for the discussion.
Thank you very much for your time.